Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks.
Hi, Ed, my co-pilot for this mission, where we send leaders and experts and super interesting people to the moon.
Everyone loves exploration. Everyone wants to go to the moon, I think. And the only thing more than that is people love movies.
They get to bring 3 movies with them and a book.
And from that, we learn strangely amazing things about life and work on our planet. Looking forward to this podcast, we have the amazing Madeline Blair. She is a leading best-selling author of the book Unlocked. She is also a TV host on E360 of the show Unlocked, where she brings different leaders and practitioners to talk about the different challenges of work. And she is one of the experts on resilience. When we're dealing with challenge, craziness, uncertainty, how do we overcome that? And she is a world-class coach at addressing that. Longtime faculty member at Columbia University. Spent a good part of her career at the World Bank as a leader there. So Madeline Blair, she's amazing.
Likewise. It's so wonderful to finally connect.
You sounded surprised by the moon reference.
Would you consider yourself an explorer by nature? If we were going to send you to the moon, is that something that gets you excited?
You have no idea how much I'm an explorer. From the time I was very little, and I mean finally able to walk and ambulate myself, I was exploring. First houses, then outside. I remember my mother saying to me one time, "You were only 3 and you disappeared and I had to find you in the big tall grass." I've always been an explorer and absolutely fascinated with outer space.
What does it make you feel? Does it make you feel exhilarated?
I'm absolutely curious. And if I can't get close to it, then I get more curious because I want to figure out.
Curiosity is not a word that comes up a lot when we talk about resilience. Do you think they're connected?
Oh, they are absolutely connected. Because in my research, I discovered that people who are highly resilient are in fact insatiably curious people.
There is that great Samuel Johnson quote that in great and generous minds, curiosity is the first passion and the last. Can I ask, when did you first meet Madeline? How did this come about?
I've been so connected with Madeline. It's one of those relationships I almost don't remember. I was still at NASA. We have joint colleagues that we've worked with. We taught together at Columbia. This is probably 25 years ago. And we come together, I think, around a love for story. Amongst other things, one of the sessions that we were in together, I saw Madeline deliver it was supposed to be a talk on story, but the way she used story to create a connection, not only was I totally captured there, but when I looked around this large room of about 50 people, everyone was totally there. We come together around common interest and use of story. And the other thing I've always said to Madeline, she's absolutely brilliant in a coaching setting. So we work together. We have the opportunity to teach courses together at Columbia. And when the students would get to the point of needing to figure out how to work issues, how to work together, how to take an issue and address a problem, there's no one better than Madeline in terms of how she would create the warmth, the ideas, the space to be able to go from where you are to where you need to be.
Madeline, with such a unique and quite powerful skill set, what would the first movie be that you bring with you on this amazing journey to the moon?
The first movie I would bring is Temple Grandin.
So how do you know where he's looking?
He can see all around without moving his head. Points his ears where he's looking. Hey, now I've got his attention. Now he's looking at me.
What are they doing?
It holds her still so Billy can inoculate.
What happened to it? It calmed down.
They just like it. Gentles them.
You know, this is a woman, and it was her mother who began saying this, that Temple was different, but not less. And that just moved me so much. As I say this to you right now, I'm moved by it. Because every person is different, but they are not less. They're just different. When I watched the movie, here was a person who was very different because she thought differently. She saw the world differently. And as a result, she was often shunned. And and even worse than that, although shunning is pretty bad. And then she ended up being this world expert on designing, of all things, slaughterhouses. And you think, wow, that's terrible. But it wasn't, because in her mind, she saw how the cattle moved, and she could see the movement as we couldn't see with our eyes, but she could see it with her eyes. And she was able to design it so that the cattle were always at ease, so that their death was instantaneous and without any trauma. And I thought that was just amazing. And of course, the reason she got to that was that she was curious. She would sit and watch the cattle at the yards. Everybody thought she was crazy. Anyway, in that show, you see that. And the videography in it was done so well, because they would show you the scene of the cattle moving in the stockyards, and then they would superimpose lines of movement. So you began to see what Temple saw. I thought that was just brilliant. One final thing from that movie that really struck me, and that is that her mother and her family gave her tremendous support. So she always had a place to get support.
Because she is kind of like the superwoman of resilience in terms of what was in her way, the resources she found, the insights she found. It's almost like a hero journey. There was a moment in that movie where she told her story in front of the group of people. She was able to articulate that her mom was a support for her. I can't watch that without actually getting really emotional.
I know exactly the scene where the audience says, but we want to know about you. And she stands up. And you're right. I tear up in that as well.
I'm glad I'm not the only muffin then. That's good.
You know, one of the things in the movie, Temple says, I think the key thing is, I think different, not less. And we've learned a lot about, you know, teams. Most of my life is projects. You need to have a variety of capabilities. I remember one person, NASA, saying you want to have this variety so you have 360-degree sight. You know, if you have all men, we tend to see things a certain way. When you add women, now you have different courage. When you have autism, visual thinking skills to the superpower augments other kinds of skills. You have to have a variety of capabilities, insights, and superpowers to be successful. There are different superpowers that historically we didn't value that now we see how important it is. And the question is, how do we pull that out? And one of the questions for you, Madeline, is in terms of that movie, what is the superpowers that you feel that you look to bring out from other people when you coach them and work with them? I'm making the assumption that part of what you love about Temple Grandin is that it becomes a platform for how to learn and develop and get solutions from different kinds of capabilities. One of your superpowers is, I've seen the coaching of students, and one of the issues is they have different skills. Sometimes they don't recognize it. And yet you're able to, in a way, I don't think they even feel it, kind of pull it so it comes together in a stream that moves forward.
When you enter into a coaching relationship with someone, the first thing you have to do is step away from it. Now, I know that sounds antithetical, but you cannot impose yourself on that other person. You have to withdraw and allow them to be. And that's what, you know, different but not less, that whole aspect. They're going to be different than me, but they're not going to be less. I'm going to learn from them. They're not going to learn from me. I guess some people call that presence. Some people would call it emptying. That's where you begin. And then the curiosity. Something that they say, oh, that's interesting, I don't know that. And you push it. You don't say that, but you ask a question.
That also explains one of the powers that I've seen you have. You're able to pull these things out. One of the techniques and other settings you do is the writing on two sides.
It's a little book called Essays in Two Voices. And you write independently, and then you never speak while you're doing the process. You only communicate via the writing. One of the ground rules is that you simply accept what the other person has written. You don't have to agree. You don't have to disagree. You don't even have to incorporate what they said into your next piece, but it's there.
It's hard to do, but the benefit from it is really powerful.
It's almost like a radical listening. I do wonder how well I listen even to more intimate relationships in my life, not just with your work colleagues, but I was like, do I even do that with my husband? Like step myself away from the ego in terms of listening to him and then being curious about some of the things he says. I don't think I do.
Well, let me challenge you to do that, because as human beings, we are actually infinite creatures, and marriage is a perfect place to be able to explore that.
The challenge accepted. I'm going to try that. I'm going to try to do that this evening. There's a saying in the Talmud that every blade of grass has an angel whispering over it, grow, grow. What you said about Temple Grandin and how important that support system is for resilience. Oftentimes, I think when people talk about resilience, they almost talk about it like an athlete alone on a track kind of running, and everything has to be this inner resource. And I see you, for those who are listening, she's shaking her head. For the complete layman, can you tell me a little bit about you and your studies on the subject, how you study it, and some of the things that you found that you're really, that you hold on to that are important?
The study that I did for the resilience was done when I was studying for an entirely different question. And not only am curious, I'm curious about learning. Ed has heard me say this many times, if I'm not learning, I'm not living. So I wanted to understand how other people learned, particularly adults who in their life, after all their formal education, must continue to bring in new, fresh knowledge for their lives. And I interviewed people, I think it was about 100 people from all over the globe, all different socioeconomic levels, all different ages. I think the youngest was 18, the oldest was 82. And I asked them questions about how they bring fresh knowledge into their lives. And when I did that, it turned out there was this little subset of people that were quite extraordinary. There was an executive who decided that he wanted to completely shift and do a pivot, and he did. So anyway, you look at these people and you say, these are amazing people. They overcame so many obstacles. What is it that they have in common? And I looked at those. And that's when I began to really see, this is evidence of resilience. And then I began to really study resilience.
Does resilience begin with a belief? I'm trying to think about the times where I did not display resilience. And I wonder if it was in part a story that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
I think it's definitely related to the stories we tell ourselves. For me, though, when I looked at it deeply, I was inspired by Viktor Frankl, who said, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our power to choose our response. It doesn't matter what's happening outside. You have the power to choose. And I said, that's where resilience lies. It's in the choice. And so if you prepare yourself to make that choice, then you just look at the options and move on.
There was an interview with one of the first female Buddhist monks, and she was saying, you know, okay, for people who are early to meditation, what's the one bit of advice you'd give them? And she thought about it and she said, before you respond, just breathe, because in that breath is an infinite amount of ways to respond. And one day you might choose to be playful and try something else. She goes, maybe you won't, but at least you give yourself that space, that opportunity. What an important movie to be bringing to the moon.
I think so.
And Claire Danes did a really phenomenal job, I think, in being in her presence.
You know, she said that the actress actually was her. I mean, she watched the movie herself and she said, that is exactly what I did. That's exactly how I looked. That's exactly how I acted. It was amazing.
I hate to do this. I don't want time to be marching on. But okay, in addition to Temple Grandin, what is the next movie?
The next movie. The next movie is Billy Elliot.
Mr. Elliot, I'm afraid that mutual respect and self-discipline are absolute prerequisites for any pupil in this school. Such displays of violence cannot be tolerated under any circumstances, do you understand? I realize we should have to consider this very seriously, and it will be bound to affect our final decision. Yes, well, just a few questions then. Billy, can you tell us why you first became interested in the ballet?
Dunno. Just was.
Well, was there any particular aspect of the ballet which caught your imagination?
The dancing?
Very different movie. This is a young boy, he's 12, 13, just beginning puberty. And his father wants him to learn to box because his father is a miner. And he knows his son's going to become a miner. There's nothing else to do in their town. So he's in the boxing ring trying to fight. He just is terrible at it. And it happened to that day, the ballet group had to use the gym to do their ballet lesson. And Billy said, that's what I want to do. I mean, he didn't say that. He just knew in his mind, that's what I want to do. And of course, the movie is all about how he inserts himself into the class, how he becomes beloved of the teacher, and how the teacher sees in him the passion. And she helps him then move on to actually be in the Royal Ballet. Now, this, of course, is an incredible story about the fight between the young boy and his father and that natural kind of thing that happens in teenagers. But, you know, the teens, that's what they're all about. They're all about finding who you are and becoming separate. We think that the terrible twos are bad enough.
Did you hear that, Ben? Wait until teenagehood. Ben has two daughters.
Really? I thought I was done by three.
No. The videography in it, the video editing, the director's role is incredible because the entire movie, you're thinking to yourself, this young man is going to break away from his father. This young man is going to become a ballerina. But I want to see him dance. In the movie, his 13-year-old dance is very choppy and anything but the smooth lift kind of ballet. The very last scene is Billy leaping onto the stage. And I mean, I just seeing it in my mind's eye, it's just, oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. I have watched this movie many times. And I always wait for that last scene. I know it's coming and I get anxious. The fact that he was finding his voice, that was the other piece that really hit me. There was the remarkable influence that a single mentor had on him as he found his voice. It reminded me of my dissertation advisor. The only admonition he ever gave me was, I want to hear your voice, Madeline, not their voice, your voice. And he was able to pull that out of me. So this is what she did for Billy.
Madeline, you are like the ideal audience any filmmaker would dream of wanting to watch their movie. You're so visually sensitive. You understand all the parts that go into it. You're story sensitive. And at the same time, you enjoy it all. I mean, that you couldn't be a better audience.
One of the things that I love is space, finding personal space, finding space to reflect, getting your team or organization out of places where you can go and you can learn and share and go in new directions. And to a certain extent, what I loved about Billy Elliot was, here is a young man who basically was creating his own space. And it's kind of a call for, this is who I am, this is how I challenge the norms, the stereotypes, to be able to be my best. And for me, it leads to a question for you, Madeline. You challenge norms and stereotypes, I believe, throughout your life. What is your unique voice, or what is the aspect of the world that you've found yourself challenging?
I despise duplicity. I seek integrity. And I know it was because that's how I was raised, that I was to go into the world and contribute to it. And I become incensed when people do not do that. But I have always spoken up to management. You know, what is it, Lee? How's it led me to where I am? I have no idea, Ed, because I really have made people angry at me.
Well, also being an executive at the World Bank as a woman, I'm assuming it was similar to NASA. We have kind of the same time frames. And when I was at NASA, it was the 80s. And you know, when I first started, it was 98% men leading things. You talked about having to learn how to challenge the environment or how to overcome it by, my term, flying under the radar.
When I was a division chief there, there were exactly six people in executive positions there, six of us. And so you not only had the male dominance, there were so few women, every one of them was looked at very carefully. So you knew you had to do things right. And you're right, Ed, I did things under the radar. I would do things very subtly. I created something, a training room, and I never asked my assistant director, I never asked my director, I never asked the VP, I'd asked nobody if I could do this. I just put it in the budget, and the budget just sort of floated through. And one day they're constructing it, and the director comes over and says, Madeline, what is this? I said, it's the training room. And I did that repeated things.
You don't wait for permission. You just do things that you feel need to be done.
Yeah. As the Jesuits say, it's better to ask for forgiveness. The bank actually used my design because this is when PCs were just being introduced. So it's in the 80s. And I had to be able to create a training room that would incorporate PCs and, you know, projection on the wall. It didn't exist before. That particular design that I didn't create it. My staff did it. That design was like for 15 years, governed all the training rooms in the bank. Okay, first I have to tell you, I grew up on a farm, and it was an egg farm principally. And my job was to collect eggs. But that's not where the story really begins. The story really begins when I entered the bank, the World Bank. I was in the computing activities department, because at that time, that's what it was called. They didn't think of it as information and things like that. It was computing. Well, I was there a couple of years and they did a big reorganization, and they created something called the customer services division, because now that PCs were going out there, well, you have to have some interaction and support to those people. So they asked me to be the division chief for this. For me, that was very natural. I love technology, but I love it because it does things for people. And secondly, I would be one of six women in that particular level. So I said yes. Everything went great for about 2 weeks. And one of my senior staff came to me at that time, closed the office door, and he says to me, Madeline, I've been thinking. And I talked to so-and-so. I'd like to transfer to his division. He said, it's okay with him if it's okay with you. And I said, you know, Bob, why is it that you want to do this? Well, he hemmed and he hawed and hemmed and he hawed. And he finally said, you know, the people here in customer services there, he didn't even have to say the word. And I'm thinking to myself, he thinks they're dregs. You know, like cold coffee grounds that you throw out. I got furious. I was furious. And so I turned to him and I said, that's a wonderful idea. And so he left. Because you see, I didn't want anybody in my division who thought that everybody around him was less than he. Just wasn't going to happen. Okay, now, in order for me to really tell you what happened, I have to go back to those eggs. Because you see, when you collect eggs, some of them get cracked. So at the end of the week, my mother would collect all the eggs together and she would put them on the kitchen table and she'd say, Madeline, bake a cake. And I'd bake cakes that had 8, 10, 12 eggs in them because you had to use the food. You know, you don't waste food on a farm. And the cakes were good because by Monday they were gone. But of course, what I learned in that was here was this cracked egg that had no economic value, none whatsoever. But within it was gold. And you could make great cakes with it. So coming back to the World Bank, I looked at my staff and I thought to myself, worse they can be are cracked eggs. 3 years later, they had achieved every business goal. They had always stayed in budget. They were in the 90th percentile of the attitude survey. Our end users loved us and we had grown 40%. We did pretty well. Those cracked eggs outperformed practically the entire bank.
It's a real lesson in leadership. Because the first thing you did was when they came to tell you something, you didn't assume anything. You approached it with curiosity. You asked a question, which I think is so interesting. And then where I would have, probably if I got furious, I'd try to teach them a lesson. Like, they shouldn't feel like that. They shouldn't be above it. You just kind of went with it. You're like, okay, if that's what they're bringing to the table, that's not going to be part of the team. And that is such a, like, a Jedi way of dealing with, I think, personality and energy. There's a lot of lessons in there, I think. So interesting. So I have to ask, because Billy Elliot also is about childhood dreams and aspirations. When you were younger, with those cracked eggs making cakes, what did you dream for yourself? Did you have a vision of what you wanted to be?
I wanted to be an astronaut. The interesting thing is the word wasn't really used when I was little. It was called space cadet or something like that. But that's what I wanted to be. And when I finally went to college, I was studying mathematics. And my mother was like, wow, I guess you can teach it, Madeline.
Now that makes that, yes. Wow. Look, I was called a space cadet when I was little, but for a very different reason. I just lose everything. I lost my winter jacket in wintertime. And when you were younger, I've never asked you this. When you were Billy Elliot's age, what did you dream of being?
I think what I was hoping was that either I'd be a great center fielder for the Mets, but I was never that talented or a great musician. That would be in a group like the Beatles. My head was always in the stars. I was the kid who I'd be walking down the block. I'd have stories going on in my head. Someone would call out my name and I wouldn't hear it. And I realized this because I would start getting people say, man, you're really snobby. I said, what are you talking about? They were calling at you. You just kept walking. So I've always been a dreamer, whatever that leads to. Yeah, I never had any thoughts about working at NASA. Never thought that would ever happen because I really, myself and math did not get along well.
If we were going to take a snapshot of maybe different points in your life, what were other points that you could see that rebellious nature?
I remember I used to do a lot of drawing. I was apparently fairly artistic. And school often bored me because I had already figured it out. But the school knew that. I mean, they understood it. I give credit to the school. I was apparently a unique student. They allowed me to do some unique things. They always put me with the good teachers, and they complimented me on all, what some people would say would be doodles, but I was drawing things, and they actually supported that.
Well, I think we should hear what is the third film, Madeline. It's going to be hard to top Temple Grandin and Billy Elliot. So the pressure's all on you. What is movie number three that you're taking with you?
Movie number three is My Octopus Teacher.
I remember the day when it all started, seeing this really strange thing. A lot of people say an octopus is like an alien. The strange thing is, as you get closer to them, you realize that you're very similar in a lot of ways.
Now, I don't know if it ever made it into theaters, because I watched it on Netflix and continue to watch it on Netflix and have watched it several times. But this was a story of a man who decided to explore a particular area of the shoreline, I think off South Africa. Very cold waters, and he had to help his body become inured to that. But he went every single day and he discovered an octopus. And so he began to observe this octopus. And the story is all about that relationship between what we would call a non-sentient being with a sentient being. And then you discover in the movie that that octopus is very sentient. And in fact, you discover that the octopus has been observing him longer than he's observing the octopus. And so again, I saw that observation on both parts, and the octopus was also curious, because as the octopus became accustomed to the diver, it would reach out a tentacle and they began to really touch one another. And then there was this one scene. It was most poignant. The octopus literally sat on the breast of the diver, and all eight tentacles spread out, embracing his body, and just sat there. It was so moving that this object, which is very delicate, very vulnerable, it has nothing on it to protect their being, and very sensate, because every one of the tentacles was receiving senses into the brain of the octopus. But the other thing that occurred to me as I'm watching this is I had a couple of wonderful interviews of a man by the name of Bruce Cryer. He's one of the founders of what's called heart math. And he says that the heart gives off energy that is 40 to 60 times more than our brains do. Now, we always think our brains are where all the power is. And as I thought about the image of that octopus resting literally on the heart of this man, it really said something to me. So it was observation, curiosity, communication through touch. And I think even the value of looking beyond what is known versus what's just right in front of you.
It's a brilliant movie. I think that to me would be one of my top 10 of all times. As a matter of fact, I love it so much. Diane and I watched it last night. Diane said when we had been talking, she said, oh, we got to see that again. It is so immersive. One of the scenes that I love is when the octopus is first exposed himself, he slowly extends one of his, arms to touch the person. you live in fear for the octopus because there's so much danger. And there's a shark that, you know, periodically comes on and the shark can kill this thing. And so there's so much danger in the environment that you wonder, I wonder, why would the octopus not just stay away all the time? But to me, the importance of relationship, the importance of connection is so important that he had built up the trust to touch this human and goes from there. But it's the fact, even with all the vulnerabilities of life, this octopus valued the relationship and the connection more than the safety.
Oh, I think that's a wonderful observation, Ed. The relationship was more important than the octopus's own life.
I have an admission. When I was little, I couldn't finish Bambi. I walked out of the movie theater, and I have a problem with animal movies because I tend to over-empathize. But with my octopus teacher, I remember watching it a long time ago and then trying to rewatch it, and it gets to the point where the shark, it ripped. I become physically sick, and I get so upset at the man filming it because my feeling is such, and I could be completely wrong, that if he were in danger, I'm very curious if the octopus wouldn't try to get involved somehow. I know a lot of, like, if seals think you're drowning, sometimes they try to, or even dolphins. And I felt he had a responsibility to help. And I know he felt he had a responsibility to not interfere. And I have such a difficult time with that.
I had the same feeling. You know, I would be going in there to try to take out the shark. But we don't mind when the octopus is ripping apart the crabs.
You're totally right. That's so true.
One of the things also this to me gets into the notion of radical engagement is that you're in relationship with someone else. To what extent do you try to protect them to the point where you take over their world? And to what extent do you value the environment so you're a part of what's going on, but you don't interfere? Guy's name was Greg Foster, I think. And he said, when I first entered this world, I felt like an alien. And then over time, I felt like I was a part of it. And being a part of it, I think, is giving room for the octopus to take care of itself and to live its own life. But it's an interesting thing of saying that I had years ago swam in the Barrier Reef, and I was by myself in this body of water. And I remember feeling, I feel like I'm on a different planet. And part of it was scary that I wanted to go back to the boat. And the other part was getting more comfortable of that environment. But yeah, it's very emotional when you part of someone or something that you love and you feel it's threatened, is the right thing to do to get involved and essentially take over? Or is it better to give the room to handle itself? Because it did handle itself. It survived.
As you were saying that, I was thinking of being a parent and those moments when you know your child is in a certain amount of trouble. Do you intervene directly or do you let them learn a lesson? And wow, that one never stops.
Again, one of your skills as a coach that I've seen with the students, it's giving the room to create their own solutions. So we sometimes work with others and, you know, they see what's happening. You know, it's not going the way they want it. And let's get it in. Let's change it. But that changes the total dynamics and maybe makes them weaker. And it's an important lesson of how do you deal with that? And how do you create that space where others can kind of live their life?
One of my favorite words when I'm coaching is when really pressed for ideas and suggestions, I always say, I suggest, so that again, the person has the choice as to whether they follow or not.
Madeline, I have this image now of you on the moon watching my octopus teacher. And then next to you, you just see this something unfurl and you find this beautiful moon creature. And now you have the opportunity, whether you reach back or not, who knows what you're going to discover up there. Before we send you off to the moon, equipped with these three now incredibly, I think, potent movies that other people who are up there will really benefit from. What are you currently working on now? What is occupying your curiosity?
Mostly what's occupying my curiosity is my show called Unlocked and finding the right people to bring in. Because in order to get on my show, I don't tell this to people beforehand, but they have to be able to either share expertise or experience. they have to exude some energy to the audience. They suck it away from the audience. Forget it. And whatever they say, it needs to be generative, because there is no point in asking people to invest their time if, in fact, they can't get something that will give them and energize them and give them life. I always felt that people had moments where their thinking changed, and I called them inflection points. So I'm having coffee. At that time, I was drinking coffee. I was having coffee with a friend in Amsterdam. Ashram Ramsey was his name. And he turns to me and he says, inflection points. Madeline, please. Nobody knows what an inflection point is. Call it mental espresso. The second thing that I do is I publish. And I published, in addition to the show, I published two other pieces every week. I published something called Mental Espresso. And Mental Espresso are clips of 1 minute or less from my shows. So I have at this point about 200 of these. And they're packaged so that there is a question from me that sets the frame. And then you hear this little clip. And the other piece that I do each week is called Grounds for Thought.
I'm noticing a theme. Are you a coffee drinker?
Actually, no, I don't.
Neither do I. That's very funny.
Grounds for Thought is just a 5 to 7 minute piece that I do, where I take something that has inspired me and I talk about why it inspires me and how it can relate to somebody else. So one of my favorite books, for example, is one called 50 Lessons from Frank Lloyd Wright. It is an incredible book. It has lots of images in it, so you can see it visually. But every one of his lessons, you can draw a corollary into management. So one of them is break the walls. It's a perfect analogy to management. Anyway, I would take that phrase, that lesson, break the walls, and I would talk about that. So that's what Grounds for Thought is.
I'm guessing you're not taking coffee with you, but in addition to your three movies, you do get a book and a snack. Do not worry about the nutritional value of the snack. You get an infinite amount and it will sustain you for whatever you need.
One is popcorn. I do love popcorn. And the other is hard-boiled eggs.
Wow, that's an interesting combination. Popcorn salted, sweet.
Salted, please.
And your hard-boiled eggs, do you like them soft in the inside or do you like a fully hard-boiled egg?
A little soft on the inside.
Having grown up on an egg farm, you're not sick of eggs.
No. Oh, no. I love eggs.
Well, they're yours. You get both, and I'm glad you get some protein along with your popcorn. And what would your book be?
You know, there is a long list of books, including that 50 Lessons from Frank Lloyd Wright. But the book that I would bring would be The Creative Habit.
Oh.
Learn It and Use It for Life by Twyla Tharp. It is a terrific book. It's so uplifting and it's so real. I remember her talking about the box that she would put her ideas into, and the box was real. People thought it was metaphorical and it was not. It was a real box. And then she would open it up.
Oh, Madeline, this is a joy. I'm so sorry we're having to send you the moon now. I am so glad to get to know you a bit. And Ed, you have some phenomenal friends. Thank you so much for populating the moon with some of the best people.
Are you saying that because you're a phenomenal friend also?
Well, you haven't sent me to the moon yet. We're still down on Earth. Okay. It's almost like the extreme version of favorite dinner party. We're just now sending all our favorite people to the moon, quarantining them there, and then we'll join
Maybe
them.
Maybe we should have a dinner party. We're about up to 15 people.
That's a great idea. We should do this in real life. Perfect. Madeline, thank you so much for your time and your brilliance and your energy. This was so great. And I think we're going to literally have to launch you to the moon. Is that right?
Go for launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Roger, go.
Well, I want to thank you too, because it has been a wonderful experience watching someone else manage the show instead of me.
Crew one for all.
Bye, Madeline. Have a great trip. Enjoy the popcorn and the eggs.
Thank you.
Break the walls.
Break the walls. Stay curious.
15 seconds.
We're going to see you soon.
Falcon 9 is configured for flight.
I hope you have a great adventure.
I will.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Stage 1 propulsion is nominal. Power and telemetry nominal. Vehicle supersonic.
Thank you so much to Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light for the opportunity of populating the moon with some of our favorite people.
with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest Madeline Blair. It was produced, edited, and with original music by me, Ben Please.
Brought to you in partnership with Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the Economic and Community Development Agency for the North and West of Scotland. HIE.co.uk